Several years ago, we made an attempt to start recording, making audio recordings of the lessons. And I'm here to tell you, the first thing I noticed when I listened to myself is, boy, what a hick. I had no idea how much I sounded like some country bumpkin that fell off of a turnip truck somewhere out past Eola. It was amazing. And so I got to listen to how many words I mispronounced and how many names I said strangely. I don't know if anybody understands a word I say. And I'm messing up English words. And now here we have a Hebrew word. So I'm going to tell you this word. I went online and I pulled it up to try to figure out how to pronounce it. And I had a pronunciation thing and pushed it. And they had some Israeli woman pronouncing this word. So I'm going to try my best. It was very pretty. Besor. I'm probably going to turn it into Beezer by the end of this lesson, but if I call it that, you know what I'm saying. But this is the Besor principle, which I've also entitled Embrace Our Role. So we're going to begin with David and the Philistines. So I've got to give you a little background knowledge before we get to 1 Samuel 30, or the whole situation doesn't make sense. Well, you're introduced to David in the Bible, and I would guess most, even the kids, can answer this question. If I was to say, fill in the blank, and I said, tell me the story of David and blank. And I bet nearly everybody would say Goliath, the big giant that David killed. Well, Goliath was a Philistine. He was of this nation. The Philistines were enemies of God's people. But all of a sudden, by the time we get to 1 Samuel chapter 27, David is going to align himself with the Philistines. So here's 1 Samuel 27 and 1. And David said in his heart, now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me no more in any part of Israel. So I shall escape out of his hand. David had a pretty sad life. From the time that he defeated Goliath, he went just to being a national symbol of, he's a national hero. In fact, they even started singing a song about him. You probably remember it. I don't know the tune, but the lyrics went something to the point of, Saul has killed his thousands, and David has killed his 10,000s. Everybody loved David. He had defeated Goliath. He had saved the nation of Israel against these nasty Philistines. But wait a minute. It didn't last very long. Next thing you know, Saul turns against David. He gets very jealous of him. And Saul even begins to try to kill him. And David has to flee, and he is on the run. He's been anointed the king, but he has not taken office yet. Saul is still the king. Saul is still in charge. And David is running for his life. This is not the first time that he has escaped to the land of the Philistines. A little earlier he did it. And there was a man by the name of Achish, who was the king of this Philistine region, the governor. And he didn't want to have anything to do with David. In fact, he even referenced that song. He said, wait a minute, this is David. This is the man Saul killed his thousands and David killed his 10,000. I don't have anything to do with it. And so David acted like he was crazy. I've already made one Corporal Klinger reference today. But David actually tried to pull the old Section 8 routine. Got down on his hands and knees and started acting like an animal. And finally the king said, I don't want you around here. You need to go. And so David was able to escape. Well, this is the second time now that David has decided, I've got to get away from Saul. Because Saul is trying to kill me. Every time I turn around, there's a spear being thrown in my direction. And so David makes the decision, I'm going to go to the land of the Philistines because I know Saul won't try to attack me in this area. So he does. And he goes back and he meets his fellow Achish, the same one that he acted like he was a crazy animal before earlier. Well, now all of a sudden he tries to convince him that he's going to be a good soldier. It says he dwelt with Achish at Gath. Gath is one of the main cities of the Philistines. It says, each man with his household, and David with his two wives, and they lived there at Achish. So I got you a little map here. This is best I can tell. Here's Jerusalem. So by this time, the kingdom was not, this is just during the time of Saul, so we didn't have the entire kingdom put together yet. Everything towards the ocean belonged to the Philistines. And so you see these towns, Gaza, I've still heard of Gaza, Gath, Ashdod, those are all the Philistine cities. There was five major Philistine cities. And so now it says David takes off and he heads towards Gath. And that's where King Achish lives. And he's confident that Saul will not try to attack him. That Saul will not follow him across the border. And he was right. Saul did not. Now we skip to 1 Samuel 27. And it says, Achish accepts David. And it says he gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah. Well, Ziklag is a city that's right outside of Gath, I suppose. No one's really sure where it is. There's several different possibilities. But the way the Philistines worked, there was five major metropolitan cities. And each city had a leader or a commander. And then each city would then kind of take on smaller areas around. Kind of like if San Angelo was the major city, and the king of San Angelo would also go annex Eola and Eden and Mertzen and just have the little towns were under his control. Well, such is the case. And you might want to know, what was David doing at this time? Well, what David was doing was he was using the city of Ziklag as his base, and he was going out attacking different people. Now, it doesn't ever say it, but I have a pretty good idea. Because Achish would always come and ask David, well, what'd you do today? Well, we went out and we attacked the Amalekites. And I'm sure when he said that, Achish had his hand out. And I'm sure Achish got a percentage of everything. He was a vassal, I suppose is what we would call it. The Bible doesn't say that, but it's pretty obvious that this Philistine king wouldn't just give away a city to some Hebrew heathen. There had to be something in it for Achish, and I'm sure he was getting part of the spoils of war. So, they would go up and they would attack all of these enemies of Israel. And I put the Amalekites, I kind of bolded that and put it in blue because that's going to be important in our story later on. I don't know where Ziklag was. I just put an X. It was somewhere in the region around Gath. There were several different little possibilities that archaeologists have found. That's as good as I can get you. But now David is actually living in the land of the enemy. He's living amongst the Philistines. And you know what the Philistines like to do, right? The Philistines like to go to war. They love to battle the Israelites. As a matter of fact, the Philistines in the next chapter are going to prepare to go to war. And so in 1 Samuel 28:1, it says, it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war to fight with Israel. That's King Saul. So the Philistines are going to attack Israel, David's old stomping ground. And so he comes to David and says, you assuredly know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men. So I don't know if he just got voluntold or if he is planning on going, but whatever the case, Achish says, this is what's going to happen. You're going to go to battle against Saul and your men. Said there were 600 men that were with David. And they were a motley crew. And we'll talk about that here in a little bit. So the Philistines begin to gather all their armies together, and they're going to have a great big old parade. So now we skip to 1 Samuel chapter 29. And it says, the Philistines gathered together all their armies in Aphek, and the Israelites encamped by a fountain, which is in Jezreel, and the lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands. But David and his men passed in review at the rear with Achish. So kind of see if we can get a picture of what's going on here. Here's our map. So I'm guessing David and his 600 men marched up to Gath, and they met up with King Achish, and then they marched up to Aphek, probably about, I guess, 70, 75 miles. They marched, and they met up with all the other troops of the Philistines, and then I would basically call it a military parade. Now, we're not real big in military parades in our country that I can tell until after the fact. We like to have Veterans Day parades and whatnot. But I get this picture in my mind almost like, I think this is from Russia, if I can tell the picture in the background. Like the old Russian troops would march by Stalin, or the German troops would march by Hitler. Or then now we've got the North Koreans will do their high stepping and they march just thousands and thousands. Well, that's what happened. It said the Philistines marched by the lords of the Philistines, so the leaders of the country. And it says that Achish was way in the back. And then way in the back behind that was David and his 600 scoundrels. And I bet they looked horrible. I bet they were just the sloppiest ragtag bunch of people you've ever seen. And here at the end of the parade, and y'all know what always comes at the end of the parade, right? That's where David's men were. They just kind of snuck their way into the parade and marched along behind them. And I couldn't help but think of this. One of my favorite movies is called The Dirty Dozen. You may remember that. It was an old movie, had Telly Savalas in it, and Lee Marvin, and it had this idiot by the name of Donald Sutherland. I don't know if you remember Donald Sutherland, but he is observing some troops, and he makes this statement. They're very pretty, Colonel, but can they fight? Well, let me tell you, David's men were the other way around. They were not pretty, but they could fight. David's men knew how to attack. They were good at battle, but they were not pretty. And when they were walking in line behind the Philistines, I bet they stuck out like a sore thumb. Because let me tell you something about David's men. If you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 22, it gives a description of David's first recruits, the first 400 recruits to his army. They were not who's who among American students. They were not ROTC graduates. It says it was everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to David. That's where David started, with those that were in distress, debt, and discontented. He took the lurches of society. He took the worst of the worst, and that was his first 400 recruits. And out of that, David, with the help of God, established himself as the king of the most powerful nation on earth. So it doesn't always matter where you start. It's how you get there and what you do when you get there. So they stick out, I'm telling you. And so as they parade through, all of a sudden, the lords or the princes of the Philistines start saying, wait a minute, I don't know about those guys. I don't really want those guys going to battle. And in 1 Samuel 29, it says they were angry with Achish. So they called Achish over, and they said, listen, I don't know where you found these guys, but they don't need to be going to battle with us. Tell them to go home. Thanks, but no thanks. We don't need David's men. Plus, they didn't really trust him. Because, remember, they're about to go to war with King Saul, with Israel. And I don't think they truly trusted that David would not turn coat on them and be a traitor to the Philistine cause. So it says, make this guy return, that he may go back to the place which you have appointed for him, and do not let him go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become our adversary. They did not trust David and his 600 ragamuffins that he had with him. So, David turns tail, and he retreats, and he marches his men back to Ziklag. But there's only one little problem. Is that in the meantime, remember, this is 75, 80 miles. I don't know how long it would take to walk 80 miles. I don't want to find out how long it would take to walk 80 miles. With packs and food and rations and all the things, the supply line that had to go with a fighting army of 600 men, it was several days of journey. And so they had to walk up, and now they're having to walk back, and I guess it's been probably at least a week since they left their homes. Only one little problem. 1 Samuel 30, verse 1. Now it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south, attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire, and had taken captive the women and those who were there from small to great. They didn't kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. So here's David's men. They've marched back, and right about the time they get home, I'm sure they can see the plumes of smoke burning from their homes. And they realize what had happened. Remember how David had gone out and I highlighted the word Amalekites? David had gone and attacked the Amalekites. Well, guess what the Amalekites did? They returned the favor. And as soon as they saw those armies marching out, I bet the Amalekites figured, here's our time, here's our chance. And they went and attacked the city. They stole all the women and children. They stole all the possessions and they burned the city. And here's David and his men returning. So David is mad. So were his men. In fact, the Bible says they were so mad that many of them said, well, what we need to do is stone David. In other words, attack the leader. And maybe that's wise, because David really had not made a very sound military decision leaving his town without a defense. But David talks him down. He talks him through the stoning and says, it's okay, here's what we're going to do. He consults the priest of the Lord and decides, should we attack? And the idea is, yes. So they're going to leave Ziklag, and they're going to start chasing down the Amalekites. And they're going to go find those sard dogs, that stole the men, the women, or the men and the children and the possessions of the land, and they're going to punish them, and they're going to get everybody back. Along the way, they meet a slave who has been left for dead along the way. That's how the Amalekites treated people. It was one of the Amalekite leaders, one of his slaves. And this guy got sick, so they just threw him off to the side and left him in the desert to die. Well, David's men come upon him. They take care of him. They feed him. They talk to him. They nurse him back to health. And the slave agreed. I'll tell you what I do. I know where they are. He said, I will lead you to the camp of the Amalekites. I'll show you right where they are. In exchange, I want my life. And so David agrees to do that. So the Bible tells us that they begin to march. Remember, they've already marched 80 miles. And then they have to turn right around and they start double time marching, I suppose, to catch those Amalekites. And it says in chapter 30, verse 9, so David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where they stayed, where those stayed who were left behind. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 stayed behind, who were so weary that they could not cross the brook Besor. Do you get the image here? These 600 men have marched some 80 miles. They get home. They see that their homes have been destroyed. The women, the children are gone. Possessions, the crops, the fields, the animals, everything is gone. So they take off automatically. And they take off again. And they go and they reach this brook of Besor. And it says that 200 of them cannot go any further. They can't go. 400 of them are ready to go. And so David makes a decision, and he tells 200 of them to stay at this brook Besor, and 400 of them go ahead and they chase down the Amalekites. That word weary, I understand by doing a little study, is associated with the word death. They weren't tired. They weren't tuckered out. They didn't need a little break. These men were exhausted to the point of death. They were physically unable to continue going. And so 400 of them continued, and 200 of them stayed there at the brook of Besor. My question is, why were 200 of the men not able to continue the fight? And I can't give you the answer. All I know is they were tired. Done a little studying on this. You know, I read, you may have heard of a Christian author by the name of Max Lucado. He's written about this. He takes a completely different approach than I do. He hammers these 200 people. He says these 200 men abandoned David in his time of need. And he's real harsh with them. And you know what? I don't see it like that. I see that there's maybe some reasons why these 200 men couldn't go any further. The Bible doesn't tell us. I'm wondering if maybe on the way back, maybe those 200 men were up in the front. Maybe they were in the front of the lines and the 400 were kind of loafing in the back. And the 200 had to be the advanced scouts. And maybe they had to do more work. They were the ones that were having to be advanced scouts and going to make sure the way was safe, and the other 400 just followed behind. I don't know. Here's another option for you. In less than a week, I'm going to turn 43. I tell you what, there's some things I can't do at 43 that I used to be able to do at 33. I'll tell you that. And there's a whole lot of things I can do at 23 that I can't do at 43 anymore. Some of y'all are probably shaking your head to say, just wait till you hit 53, or 63, or 73, or 83. You know, the body just starts to get out. Maybe these 200 men were old. Maybe they were the old soldiers who had been with David the longest. Maybe they just physically could not go any further. I get it. I understand. You know, there's that old song, I'm not as good as I once was, but I'm as good once as I ever was. You know, maybe they could get it all together once, but to go from an 80-mile march and then turn around the next day and go on another one in double time, maybe they just physically could not do it. I read another commentator, and he said, you know what? Maybe these 200 were the ones that had wives and children that were taken. Maybe they just couldn't go, and, you know, they're devastated. Could you imagine walking home and seeing your house burned down and your wife and all your kids and everything, your possessions gone? Can you imagine the overwhelming physical toil and mental anguish that would take on you? But some people think, well, maybe these 200 were the ones that lost the families. And they just couldn't take it anymore. And the 400 didn't. And so they were kind of ready to go. Maybe they were young. I don't know. I don't know why these 200 couldn't go. But David did make a decision. And David made a decision to leave these 200 men at the brook Besor. And they left all the supplies there. And so they manned and protected the supplies. And the 400 went on. And they had a resounding victory over the Amalekites. They recaptured everything that they had lost. They recaptured all the women, all the children, all the wives, all the possessions. Oh, and they also took some of the possessions of the Amalekites. So they got a little bit extra on their return home. Well, then something happens. Remember I told you, David's men were not of the highest caliber. They were not the best people. Remember, they were the ones who had been, what was it, distressed, in debt, and discontented. They were kind of shady. And so as these 400 return, 1 Samuel 30:22 says, all the wicked and worthless men, that's a good way to describe David's army. In some translations it says the men of Belial. And that's what it means. It's these wicked, worthless, sorry dogs that David was commanding. They were not great people. Then all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David answered and said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. Listen, you sorry dogs. If you're not going to go to battle with us, then you don't get any of the spoil. Instead of dividing the spoil, the extra stuff, instead of dividing it 600 ways, we're going to divide it 400 ways. Because y'all didn't do anything, because y'all were too tired and too weak and you couldn't go any further, so y'all don't get any extra stuff. And I got thinking about it at first glance. Is that what the Bible teaches? If you don't work, you know where I'm going, right? 2 Thessalonians 3:10, for even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. If you're not going to do the work, should you be rewarded? So my question is, does this apply to the situation at Besor? And the answer is, in King David's eyes, no, it wasn't the same. Just because they weren't actually in the battle, they were still part of the army. They still had a job to do. They still had a role to do. They were protecting the supplies, which may not be as glamorous as those who went into battle, but they had a job to do, and it was important, and David realized that. So David said, my brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered us into our hand the troops that came out against us. For who will you heed in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike. And David says, I don't care if you're a frontline soldier or if you're one of the ones working in the back. If you're part of the army, if you're part of the group, everybody shares alike. Just because they didn't pull the sword out doesn't mean that their contribution is any less important than what those frontline soldiers was. And it said that became the rule from henceforth. And so that became the rule of the nation of Israel. Anytime they went to battle, that's what happened. It didn't matter who was actually on the front lines. The entire army gathered a reward. That was in the law of Moses. David was just doing what had been commanded. Numbers 31:27, divide the spoils equally between the soldiers who took part in the battle and the rest of the community. So the soldiers benefited and the community benefited. It wasn't, though, they weren't going to have a checklist. Well, okay, well, you killed 6 people, so you get this percent. And you only killed 2 people, so you get this percent. And you didn't kill anybody, so sorry. It didn't work like that. If you were part of the army, you got part of the spoils. That's just the way it was. It was divided out evenly. And now we have the Besor principle. I think there's a principle here. Every role in an organization is necessary. It's important. And it's worthy of rejoicing. I think that's important to know. Because sometimes we forget about that. Sometimes we get too caught up in sometimes the glamour positions. And I'm not just talking about the church. I'm just talking about in general. The fellow that's on the TV screen, the guy behind the scenes is just as important. You know, we have the surgeon. Well, that nurse is just as important as the surgeon. And for every person, there's probably 50 that are behind the scenes that without their efforts, the person in the glamour position wouldn't be able to do anything. And I think that's the case in the church as well. We talk about how many speakers we have and this and that, and that's important because we need to have people that are leaders of the church. But we also need to have those that stay behind and guard the supplies. Yeah, one job's not more important than the other. And so sometimes we get down and we say, oh, this congregation, we've only got this many teachers, or we're really struggling, we only have one or two teachers. There's other people that can do things. They may not be able to step out and teach, but they can guard the supplies. And if everybody will take their role and their responsibility seriously, the church will grow. Because that's one of David's precepts. It's the Basor principle. So I'm going to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Kind of a long reading, so I won't read all of it. But remember how 1 Corinthians chapter 12 goes? He's talking about spiritual gifts, and then he's talking about the body. He says, for as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, and have been made to drink into one Spirit. For in fact, the body is not one member, but many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I am not of the body, it is therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, what would be the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where would be the smell? But now God has set the members, each one of them in the body, just as He pleased. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? Isn't that a great passage? We all have different strengths. We all have different abilities. We all have different roles. And when you put them all together, you have a strong body. And that's what we need. Don't ever discount your role in the church because you're not a teacher or because you're not an elder or whatever the case may be. Don't ever discount your role. Do it to the best of your ability. And if we will all make a commitment to do that, the church will grow. Found this in a book I was reading. It's called The 17 Indisputable Laws of Teamwork. It's a book by John Maxwell. And he gave a story about Winston Churchill I thought was pretty appropriate. Winston Churchill, of course, was the Prime Minister of Great Britain during World War II. And he said one problem that they had in England back in those days, they could not find people to be coal miners. Because all the coal miners wanted to go into the military. And so the morale of the co-workers was terrible. And so it said that Winston Churchill went down to this big old group of coal miners and gave a speech. And he just gave this outline. He said, I want you to imagine when the war is over. I want you to imagine the great parade that we're going to have. He said, first are going to be our Navy members that have helped to supply the country. And then second, he said, are going to be our Air Force pilots who defeated the German Luftwaffe. And he said, and thirdly, he said, it's going to be those soldiers that escaped from Dunkirk, if you saw that movie recently. He said, fourthly, it's going to be the coal miners with their hats covered in dust. And people might ask, well, why are the coal miners there? He said, because without those coal miners, none of the other three could have accomplished their jobs. Everybody's role was important. And I said, the coal miners returned to their jobs with great luster, knowing that they had done something to help the cause of their country. I think that's kind of the same way with the church, too. But I have a couple corollaries I want to add to you. So this is the Basor corollary. So there's our role. Every role in an organization is necessary, it's important, and worthy of reward. Here's our corollary. We should always look for ways to improve our individual service, whether we're on the front line or working behind the scenes. So as we enter 2018, I'm going to challenge us all. Whatever we do, do it better. Whatever you see your role in the church, do it better. Try to improve. Always look for ways to improve what you do. If you're a speaker, try to be a better speaker. If it's your job to clean the building, try to clean the building a little bit better. Whatever the case may be, whatever our role is in the church, always try to improve and do more. I think that goes for families as well. Whatever our role is in the family, try to improve it. Try to improve upon our role and do everything we can to the absolute best of our ability. And learn from where we've done wrong in the past and try to get better. I think that's a great admonition to us. We need to learn from our mistakes.
I thought about this, and none of the commentaries that I've read after, including old Max Lucado, none of them have come up with this, but I thought about this.
Why were David's men in this position in the first place? Why did they have to go chase the Amalekites down? You ever thought about that? I'll tell you why. It's because David made a critical mistake. Because David did not leave any reserves at the town of Ziklag. He left the town open. He took all 600 of his men to the big parade. He didn't leave anybody in reserve. He didn't leave anyone to guard the supplies. And maybe David realized, boy, that was kind of a dumb thing to do. So when he had another opportunity to fix it, he didn't have any problem saying, okay, y'all 400 are going to go attack. Y'all 200 stay and guard the supplies. Had he done that the first time, none of this would have happened. So I think David learned from his mistake. I've got one more corollary to add to. We'll bring this lesson to a close. Everyone should be prepared to take their turn on the front line. So yeah, sometimes you get to stay in the back. Sometimes you get to guard the supplies. But there's coming a day, when you may be called upon to take more of a role. To take more of a role in the church. Take more of a role in your families. Take more of a role in your business, in your schools, whatever the case. There's coming a time where we may have to do more. So don't ever discount those that are working behind the scenes, so to speak. Don't ever discount your role. But at the same time, know that that may not always be the case. This time, for these 400 went and these 200 stayed. Guess what? On the next battle. And then those numbers may have mixed up a little bit. We always have to be ready and prepared to join the front line. So in conclusion, David had to make a decision. And I think this decision defined his leadership. And it defined, really, it set a standard that the children of Israel used throughout their battles. And it was even copied by the Romans. They did the same thing. All would receive a reward despite their role in the battle. You did not have to be actually in the battle to receive that reward. And I think that is taught in the Bible, so I think that's biblical. We're all on the same team. Number two, God has use for everyone, but we must always strive to improve. Don't ever get complacent. Don't ever get into a rut where we feel like, well, this is all I can do for the church. This is all I can do for my family. I'm just going to stay right here and try to fly underneath the radar, so to speak. We can't do that. We always have to try to improve and to get better and to do more than what we've done in the past. And thirdly, when the time comes, everybody must be prepared to join the front line. And that's how the church is sustained. Because if not, I hate to break it to you, but people get old. And when people get old, eventually people are going to die. And if we don't have people ready to assume their position on the front line, when that happens, that means the church dies. And what a sad, sad situation that is. We always have to be ready to assume our positions. And so there we have the Besor principle. Based on the story of David as he ran down chasing those Amalekites. So again, Jeff, I appreciate your story. I thought that was an awesome story. And there's my take on it.